I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we will be talking about the adultification of black girls. So I've got two special guests with me today, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves.
Hi, everyone. My name is Grace Masuro. I am an inclusion strategist and coach. I'm also a podcast host, so my podcast is called The Organisational Inclusionist. I am acting CEO for an anti-racism charity as well called Every Future Foundation. And I have a beautiful 12-year-old daughter who is my absolute world. And I know all mums say that, but she is.
Great stuff.
My name is Aziz Minot. I am co-founder of 2 to 3 Degrees, and we are a personal development company. So we travel up and down the UK, working with young people to teach them the practical skills that we wish we learned in school, such as confidence building, resilience, how to network with different professionals. And we've been doing that for nearly 9 years. But I'm also a public speaker and speak on lots of different issues, including politics and black affairs pertaining to ecology and green issues as well. So very, very, very excited to be talking about this issue.
Just giving you guys your flowers. That's amazing, man. You guys are doing some great stuff. So on today's episode, as I said, we're going to be talking about adultification. Adultification is a new term to me. I sort of came across it, you know, during work. This was about 2 years ago after, you know, a prominent case that happened in East London around Child Q. And that's something we'll talk about a bit later on. And for those who don't know, adultification is essentially a bias where adults treat young people as older and more mature than they actually are. And to sort of start off with, I want to know, when did you guys first hear about this term adultification, like even being used? Like, you may have had the experiences, you know, in your childhood or in school, but in the actual term adultification, when did you guys first hear it being used?
It was actually when I had a conversation with you.
Oh, wow.
I hadn't heard of it, but as soon as we kind of started discussing it and looked into the detail and the history and what it means and the definitions, I was like, okay, I know exactly what this is. Mm. Sometimes you don't have language for something, but you can identify with it or know when you've seen it or experienced it. And I think that's really powerful about this term as well, because I think it's something that a lot of people might be able to hear and not necessarily know what it means straight away. But when we start breaking it down, identify that for themselves, the part that they play or what they've experienced.
Yeah.
No, definitely. I actually came across the term when my daughter was in primary school. So she was getting in, proportionate amount of trouble compared to what she was actually doing in school. Mm. So I'd be getting emails home. She'd be getting kept back for a detention. I'd say, what for? And they'd say, oh, we told everyone to line up and she was still running around the playground. Mm. She's 6. Okay, that just means you haven't caught her attention.
Yeah.
So I started to go back and forth with the school a lot about it. And something told me, you know, just Google this. Like, this is definitely because she's a black girl. There weren't that many black girls in her school. Where we live is not as diverse as it could be, right? And particularly her school. So I researched it and the term adultification, particularly for black girls, came up. And yeah. I was like, this is exactly what's happening to my child. Like, and I emailed the school and included the word in. Like, this is what's happening. And I'm not going to stand for it. You're looking at my child and you're seeing a black woman when she's a black girl. And I need you to treat her as such, because I know that her white girlfriends aren't getting treated in the same way for doing the exact same things.
Yeah.
And almost throwing it back to the school, like, I need you guys to dissect why her behavior is viewed so differently to her friends who aren't the same color as her. That's when I came across the term.
And how did the school respond to you using that term adultification? Did they address that?
They So, you know, at the time, the school weren't going to just hold their hands up and say, yes, this is happening, especially because they weren't necessarily aware that that's what they were doing.
Mm.
But one of the things they did do going forward was really check themselves. So yeah. actually, it, does this warrant a detention? Does this warrant contacting her mum? Or can we just ask her not to do that?
Yeah.
You know, so the number of interactions I was having with the school were becoming fewer and fewer. And I think this is a big thing about having conversations like this is, you know, I don't necessarily think that bias or discrimination necessarily takes place as a result of, you know, ill intention or people like maliciously wanting to do it. I think a lot of it happens because people aren't even aware of it. They're not even aware of the biases they have. So my thing is this, I'm going to educate you where I can. It's now up to you what you do with that education.
No, that's very helpful. And how do you think viewing, you know, a young black girl as older or more mature than they actually are impacts their social and emotional development?
It's funny because I was thinking about this in the context of my experience, not only in school, but in family background as well, and like how I was brought up. So I'm the eldest of two. And as the older girl, there's a lot of responsibility that we assume. And I don't know if it's just because you're the eldest or it's because you're the first girl out of the children. But it meant that, you know, there's almost like I'm an additional parent to my younger brother. And there's an additional level of responsibility there. And what they do and what their results are also a reflection of me. Whereas I'm a child.
Oh. Yeah.
So why did I adopt that? Yeah. I don't know where that came from, that sense of responsibility, but also how that manifests in the home. So am I required to do more cleaning or more cooking or more house duties? Is there a higher expectation from me as the woman, as a girl, well, actually really a girl because I was just a girl, than my brother at the same age? And yeah, 100%. You see that in the family home. And it might even happen within black cultures, but you also hear about it happening in other cultures as well, particularly Asian background. So I just wonder to what extent that had an impression on me, so much so that I had to be super responsible when it came to school. There was no way I could mess around. It's me first, and I'm setting the example for my siblings. And if I don't do well, then if he doesn't do well, then that is definitely on me. And that sense of being a parent before my time, I think, had a big impact on me feeling a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
I felt like I had to get good grades. I had to make the right decisions. But actually, I was growing up. I didn't know. So why should I have had the pressure of needing to get it all right? And I think hand in hand, it can come with the education system. And I know that's a bigger conversation on this podcast, but that must also play a part in that. But particularly for black women, I think it's also layered and it adds a lot of weight.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with that. And, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, my sort of mindset two years ago when, you know, when I was having my firstborn. And I remember saying to everyone that I wanted a girl first.
Exactly.
And purely because I wanted someone mature. I wanted someone mature and I wanted someone, you know, responsible to sort of like lead like the household.
The
but I don't even know where that sort of mindset or influence, you know, comes from. And it's interesting that,
Weirdly enough, I went to an event the other day and a young person said to me, a young woman said to me, or a young lady said to me, guys who have sisters first respect women more.
Yeah.
And I don't know to whether...
Guys who have daughters first.
No, guys who have sisters
big
first.
Big sisters.
Oh.
So to your point, like wanting a girl first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It does something to the next generation or the next siblings, should I say, that inspires them in a different type of way. And I don't know what that is. I don't know what
I think so as well. Like so I can identify a lot with your experience growing up. I was the firstborn as well. So I've got two younger siblings. And I feel like as soon as I came out of the womb, it was, you're the firstborn, you're expected to set the example. If they did anything bad, it was my fault. And I've got my brother is 32 years old, right? And whenever I introduce him to people, I say, this is my baby brother. He's my firstborn child. And every time I say that, my daughter's like, what? I'm like, you don't understand. Like, his nappy needed changing. I was there. If he called for mum, I would answer. It used to get on his nerves. But I was like, ask mum. Ask mum who your mum is. Ask her. Because I did. I was running around after that little boy. I think for me, though, what it really did was it meant that there wasn't really a safe space for me to just be a child. Because in my house, I was expected to be the responsible one. At school, I was seen as a big woman, even though I was a child. And even in the street, if my parents weren't there, I was also always very aware of, like, if one of my aunties sees me misbehaving, I'm finished. Because, you know, I'm Nigerian and it's very much the village raises the child. So my auntie could hold me up in the street and beat me. Like, I couldn't say nothing. So it was just this feeling of never being able to just be, you know. And I think that what that did to me and what I know it's done to a lot of Black women is that it develops us into women who feel like we have to be perfect, like everything has to be perfect. There's no room for us to make a mistake. There's no room for us to disappoint our parents. It's exhausting. And that's why we talk a lot about burnout, particularly impacting Black women in the workplace, in the homes, because of that early adultification so that we experience. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I think, I had similar sort of experience in terms of being or having that responsibility. And I was the second oldest, you know, in my family. And I recall, I think it was like last year or the year before last, my sister, who's, I'm bad with birthdays, so I'm sorry, I don't even know how how old she is. Like 20, I'm going to edit this bit out. I'm going to have to edit this bit out. But my sister sent me a message, a happy birthday message, and saying, oh, you know, you've always been like a dad to me. And, you know, it was heartfelt, and I thought, wow. And then I also felt like, but your dad's around. Your dad's around. But it just sort of takes us back to that experience of the responsibilities that we, you know, sort of assimilated, especially within like the family, like within the family context. And, you know, we sort of talk about it in school, but actually it was happening within, you know, the home as well.
I think it also links to generations, right? So like if you're first or second generation, this massively impacts how much it affects you. So let's say your parents never went to university. You are doing that stuff by yourself. You're teaching your parents what to do. What if your parents need help with a CV and they've in your first generation and they're learning to navigate the employment system here? We know friends who have sat down with their parents editing their CV cover letter.
I'm friend.
So doing emails, you know what I mean? Again, that's another version of it in the home. And we haven't even spoken. And that's just to get by and to live. We're not talking about what happens if there's a family breakdown. So I experienced a family breakdown and I was 11, eldest. And when I say it was a direct split, so my parents were talking to me about situations happening in court cases that they were fighting against each other as if to say I'm the media. I'm an 11-year-old child also going through this and having to process this, but never having the space to process it. And so, you know, it was almost like I had to have answers. They was asking me, so what do you think about this? What do you think? And it's like, I don't have anything to say. But knowing that my responsibility wasn't really in responding to them or fixing the situation, although I did have a feeling of like, how can I fix the situation? And feeling helpless that actually I'm a child and I cannot fix the situation. So it's all mixed up in a melting pot of frustration, but expectation, self-expectation, external expectation, on top of suppressing emotions that you might need in life to just vent to someone, you know, as a child.
Yeah, definitely.
And beyond the sort of family home, if we think about, you know, the school context, and I'm thinking particularly in regards to, you know, from my experience, the language that teachers would use towards me in school, especially around that sort of sanctioning or discipline. And it was, oh, you know, you need to be, you know, responsible when you go out into the working world. You know, things are not gonna. I'm 12. Mm. I'm 12 years old. Like, yeah. I don't care about the working world right now. I just care about, you know, doing whatever it is that I'm doing, you know, in that moment. And, you know, there was often that experience of actually, you know, just not being allowed to be a kid. And similarly, there were extreme experiences of, oh, you've done something, or you've been in trouble, or you've got a fight, or you've got into a fight and whatever else. And there's like threats around, like, sort of like criminal type punishments, and, you know, references of, you know, police being involved, and, you know, all of these other things. And that impacts, you know, that definitely impacted me as a young, you know, black boy. Do you guys have any sort of experiences, especially within a school setting, whether it's yourself, you know, daughters, nieces or nephews, where there's been those experiences of adultification, but within a school setting?
So my daughter, here's the thing. So I raised my daughter very differently to the way that I was raised, because I'm very conscious of the adultification that I experienced in my household. But also, I'm very conscious of just how much we talk about now. So one of the things that I deliberately didn't do with my daughter for a long time was talk to her about the fact that her race means that she will be viewed differently by people in this country and across different parts of the world, right? Because I wanted her to keep her innocence for as long as she could keep it. Mm. It was only when she started to get into trouble at school that I had to explain to her, because for her, she was like, I don't care, I'm just being a child, you know? So she'd just carry on.
Yeah.
And I had to explain to her that there is a difference between you and your friend. And, you know, running around doing that leaves to do that, because it's not name that gets called when it's time to report back to mum, right? Yeah. So, you know, my experience of adultification was really with my daughter and observing it. I think growing up, while I was living it, I wouldn't see it myself, because I was just trying to not have someone phone my mom, because they used to regularly say, we'll call your mom, because they knew what my mom was about. They knew that if my mom came, I would get beaten in front of whoever was there. And I feel like they almost enjoyed that a little bit. It didn't happen often, but they loved the fear that it evoked in me. You know, if anyone said they're going to call my mom, the way I would shake.
Yeah.
And I'd be really upset about it, because it did feel like abuse. Also, particularly because they knew that the culture that I come from, disciplining isn't just telling off. Like, they know you're going to get a full lashings. Yeah, and that wasn't allowed in this country. But they almost seem to find that entertaining. Like, oh, look how scared she is. Oh, she's scared she's going to get beaten.
Yeah.
That's not funny. Mm. So, yeah, my most aware state of knowing and seeing adultification is through my daughter. And that's because I choose to be potently aware. If you spoke to my mum now and said to my mum, you know, do you feel like your daughter was adultified while she was younger? My mum would be like, what's that? You know, no, it was normal. You know, we expected her to do this. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Standard. But I feel like this generation now, we're having the conversations that weren't taking place back in the day. And so it feels different. But I definitely, for me, in terms of personally, when it started, it definitely started in my house, but then it occurred in a different way outside. So in my house, I was being raised to be a mother. I was being raised to be the caregiver, the house help, all of that stuff. And the responsible one that went to uni and got all these great grades. And then in the streets or at school, I was being treated like a black woman who society saw as less than. And wanted to oppress. So it was tricky. But secondary school was completely different, though. My secondary school was amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I was black in secondary school. My teachers were on point. They loved me. They supported me. They advocated for me, despite the fact that there were no black teachers in my school when I was there. So I was really lucky in that sense. But I know not everyone was.
Yeah. And that's interesting to hear. And there'll be so many other young girls or even adults who are listening to this, reflecting back on their secondary experiences. Mm. And one, it could trigger certain things and they're saying, actually, do you know what? Like, I remember experiencing this. Mm. But similarly, it may not trigger anything.
Mm.
And that in itself is a concern because it may suggest that it was happening so like regularly, or they've just got this detachment for it that they...
Or they normalised it.
They normalised it. That they just felt that actually this was happening to everyone. Mm. So I didn't see my teacher doing this becoming an issue, or I didn't see my teacher saying this becoming an issue when it actually was.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I went to an all-girls school, and the biggest stat from our school was that no one in our school had a child during school year, and we had oldest years who what they consider just really, really naughty, like really bad. We used to have different color shirts for your when you start, and this color, once that year group went, they deleted that color completely. They said we need a new one because maybe the color influenced them, and this was a Catholic-based school.
The color's jinxed.
So they said absolutely not. And
what
so
was the color?
It was red.
Oh, see, I don't wear red, you know.
Really?
I'm scared of that colour.
Interesting.
I wore one red dress and someone's like, you don't really get it. It's the devil's colour.
Uh-uh.
I'm not going to.
Wow.
I don't like it.
Oh, no.
So I hear the school. I'm glad they scrapped it.
Okay. So I don't know. And I've been reflecting on my experience in school. And I've really tried to understand, like, what was my honest feeling about the way we were conditioned in school? And I don't know. I guess that's the, and I think it's to your second point, like, I actually don't know whether it was or it wasn't, but then here's my experience. They put us in streams, so it's like based on academic results. And so my experience as a high academic achiever, I'm more favoured in school. So I can't speak for the experience of the other black girls who were in my year group who may have been treated less than or more than more in a way that they should be, like an adult think. Actually, do you know what? I just remembered. They said to a group of students who they believed might have children early on, they put them on a specific course. Now, I'm not going to lie. I loved learning. So me, I wanted to be on that course. Not because I felt like I was going to be there, but I wanted to be on the course. But because they were like, this doesn't suit you on what you're expected to achieve because of your grades.
Mm.
I think they kind of excluded. And then that resulted in me wanting to misbehave in school, which quickly got quashed with the head teacher bringing in my parents saying, we've just seen a massive decline in Aziz's attitude. But it was because I felt like certain groups were being favoured with extracurricular. But then looking back now, I realise it wasn't really that. It was trying to expose some more at risk, maybe, high students to different things that they could consider. However, I don't know to what extent that was the right intervention for them. And as a teacher, I guess you might have a view.
What's the sort of line between a student being, you know, at risk of, you know, exploitation and whatever else, and this idea of adultification, which suggests that sometimes adults have this view, especially of young black girls, that they're more promiscuous. That's actually a viewpoint that they see young black girls and they think, oh, like, you're more promiscuous. You must have had sex. You must have done X, Y, and Z, you know, by a certain age. And how do you, like, I don't know. I find that
really interesting. So a couple of things for me. That the first one is, I spoke to a friend of mine a few years ago, and I was talking about how great I thought our secondary school was, because she went to the same school, and her experience was completely different to mine.
Mm.
And it was because I was in the higher set and she wasn't. And it never crossed my mind that actually you were treated differently based on how you might impact the school's rating on Ofsted or whatever.
Yeah.
So that is a really, really fair point, actually. And I think that probably did play a role in why my experience was different. In terms of that black girls are more promiscuous thing, I don't know where that comes from. Because, you know, growing up, like, I was called, I remember this boy. So there was this group of girls, and we used to always hang around in Stockwell. So I finished school at 3:30. I had to be home by 4. Only took me about 20 minutes to get home. So I'd spend 10 minutes in Stockwell on the platform. And there was this boy talking to some of the girls that went to my school. And I think he was like looking at me like he wanted to talk to me. And then he was like, "Nah, but you look like a virgin." And then all the girls from my school started laughing at me. And I was thinking, I don't understand what's wrong with looking like a virgin. Like, yeah. It was really strange to me. But growing up, I don't know that I ever saw like my friends just out here in the streets doing a madness. Like, so this black girls are more promiscuous thing, I think, again, it's because you're not looking at them as black girls, you're seeing black women. And obviously as a woman you are able to have sex because you're an adult, it's legal. But you're looking at these children as if they're adults, which is why it's easy for you to say they're promiscuous, because you're seeing black women in front of you, not black girls. But yeah, I don't know where that came from, because I didn't, don't get me wrong, there were a few girls who, you know, got pregnant quite young and whatever, but I saw that across the races.
Yeah,
it wasn't prolific amongst black girls. Yeah. So I really don't know where that came from.
And I wonder if it's a projection, like you said. Yeah. It's more of the idea that certain people fetishize black women more than it actually being true.
Definitely.
Because I'm not familiar with that in my experience growing up either.
Yeah.
But then saying that, teachers were, and again, I don't know if just because we were rowdy young people, but like they were strict on us. They were like, "You girls better," da, 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 da. And back to the point of talking about the effects of what we're doing in school, how it's going to change our whole life, and we're going to become nothing in life because of it. And it was like, who are we actually talking to? Are you actually talking to children, whose brains are not fully developed? Like, if we get into the psychology of this now.
Exactly.
You're dealing with dealing with young people whose brains are not fully developed at a time of day and a sleeping pattern that they've not fully become accustomed to for themselves, and they're going through a load of emotional things that they're not even aware of. There's a lot in that that actually, if we even look at the whole education system, it's like, is this the right time of day for young people to be learning when they're still asleep? And also trying to educate them in a way that they're being most productive. When we know there's science that says they're not working high functioning at this time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm sort of reflecting back on my experience as a head of year, and, you know, how I would engage with my students, especially the black students, you know, the black female students or the black male students. And I always had that sense of just seeing them like as like a younger sibling. So I couldn't even adultify them, because it, just in terms of, you know, my sort of race and my background and knowing, you know, and having that sort of cultural competence where I know, you're Nigerian, mum's dad strict, like, like calling me on the phone saying, "Yeah, sir, whatever you need to do." But I just saw you as, okay, your younger brother, your younger sister, and I'm gonna take care of you. So I'm gonna have that sort of added extra nurture, you know, in the way I engage with you. And, you know, we was having this conversation earlier as well before we started recording, where we was basically saying, there's other educators who aren't black that need to consider when they're engaging with, you know, with students, and there's certain, you know, outcomes, whether it's a student's been sanctioned or something's, you know, being said, what's the sort of lens or what's the direction that you're engaging with the young person with? Are you engaging with them, you know, they're a black girl, but you're seeing them as like a black woman or a black boy, but you know, you're seeing them as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've seen experiences where, no, I'm going to say I've seen experiences, but I'm going to talk about my own experience for accountability. There was one student when I first started as a head of year, and I was 26 years old when I was head of year, and the student was in year 10. And the way he was talking to me was a bit, and I'm still like one I'm still like 1 foot in East London, but 1 foot, I'm, you know, head of year. And I literally got to his face, and I'm paraphrasing, and I must have said, like, what's going on? What are you doing now? But in that moment, and I'm thinking really about this idea of adultification, I wasn't seeing him as a year 10 boy. I was seeing him as, if you're talking to me like that, you think you're on my level. So I need to react and approach to you on that level, because now you're talking like me and you are the same age. So now I've approached you. And you can tell he looked at me and he was like, yeah, this guy's forgotten I'm a student. Like, this guy's forgotten I'm a student. And I had to really check, you know, myself. But I've seen it with other teachers as well. White teachers and black male students. The confrontation, the back and forth, the no one's wanting to back down, that everyone's... It's like, yo, they're a child, they're angry. Like, what, you know, like, how are you going to manage that? So that's so interesting. And sort of moving forward, what do you think, like, how do you think adultification sort of limits the opportunities for, like, black girls to really, you know, be vulnerable and express themselves and seek support, whether it's through adults in school or even, you know, at home? We was talking about that, you know, a bit, but how do you think that that limits them?
I think we're quite lucky in the society that we are today that a lot of us aren't first or second generation. Well, second generation, maybe, but second and beyond. So we've learned from what we went through and we're trying to raise our children differently. I think that for me growing up personally, asking for help or being vulnerable wasn't something I ever considered. My mum didn't raise me that way. My mum explicitly told me, you don't talk about what's happening outside of this house to anybody. And also my mum's messaging and what I saw from her, what she role modeled was, no matter what's happening, be strong, carry yourself with composure, respect yourself, respect this household, respect where you come from. So it was always about, even if you weren't okay, you behave like you are okay. Whereas what I'm trying to raise my daughter to do is understand it's okay not to be okay. And if you're not okay, tell us. But my daughter is very, and I partly blame myself for this. And my daughter is very, she's not a big communicator. She's not very emotional. And I think it's because she's been through more trauma by the age of 12 than I had experienced before I was 18. So she lost her granddad when she, well, first to start, her mum and dad got divorced when she was, right before she turned two. Her granddad died when she was six. Her mum got breast cancer when she was eight. Like, she's been through a lot. And through all of it, because we were so focused on making sure she was okay, we didn't show her any emotion. So I got on with it. You know, I was cool. Whenever she was around, I was laughing, I was joking, I was smiling. She never got to see me sad. Like, even, so even if you ask her today, like, how did you feel when mummy had cancer? She'd be like, I didn't really feel like she was sick because she still took me to school. She still cooked. She was still herself. So I definitely take responsibility for that. But she's 12 and she's going through so much, you know, like things that the girls go through, hormones, cattiness, all of that.
Yeah.
And my messaging is always like, it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me what you're feeling. I'm not going to be upset with you.
Yeah.
As long as you manage your tone. Like, we can talk about it.
Yeah.
And I'm really trying to create that in her. I'm even trying to get her into counselling because I love counselling. Mm. Well, my daughter doesn't want to talk to strangers, but we're going to get there because I think it's really important. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it. I think growing up, it wasn't an option for me personally. Mm. I'm really trying to break the cycle with my daughter because I don't want her to be big 40 years old feeling like she's having to learn how to feel.
You know what's so interesting about my experience? So my parents are super open and they've always encouraged me to talk, including my dad. I've had so many deep conversations with him, or he's had to help me through like menstrual cycle issues and stuff like that. And so that's been really, really encouraging. But I think, ironically, I think they also saw me as an adult very young. Mm. And the way I carried myself gave them confidence that I'd be okay. Mm. So, for example, when I was probably 12, I went to my first under 16s rave. And my parents, like, dropped me there, picked me up. And they knew I was going to be okay. And this was something that throughout my teenage years, I was able to, like, go raving. Or I even went on my first girls' holiday to Ayanapa when I was, like, 17 or something. No, I must have been 18. Must have been 18 then. But again, it's like, you see me? It's not my child. Mm-mm. Absolutely not my child. But it's also because even though to be honest, I thought I was grown. So people were probably treating me grown. I was acting grown, and all of that in between kind of made sense because I used to live in East London. I used to travel in Newham, and I used to travel all the way to Tower Hamlets for school. Then I used to go to Angel Islington for acting school and travel all the way back. Or when I moved further out into Essex, I had to still do that route. So that's traveling quite a lot around London as a young, I think I'm tall, but I'm not, but a relatively small, young black woman, and having to navigate the streets like that. I don't think I would allow my children to do that. Mm. But then again, if you are treating your child in a certain type of way, you're talking to them in a type of way, they're producing academically in a way that you're expecting them to, then there's no reason that you would necessarily limit them and their options.
I weren't allowed to go nowhere. Wow. Nowhere. I remember my dad said when I was 15, Immature were in town. I don't know if you guys know Immature.
No.
It's showing my age.
I know Immature.
Thank you. Immature, B2K,
right,
are kind of like the younger version of Immature.
Oh, sorry, I can see their face.
And Immature were coming to town for concert, and all my friends were going from school, and I was like, Dad, please can I go? I've been really good. My dad told me I could go. And then when it was time to buy the tickets, my dad was like, you're not going anywhere. I was like, so why did you say I could go? And he was like, so you'd stop asking me.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't allowed anywhere. I remember one time as well, my mum said I could go out to meet my friends in Streatham. I grew up in Clapham Common. I was leaving the house at 7. She said, be back by 9.
Mm.
It was going to take me 30 minutes, maybe 40 minutes to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, but mummy, I won't get long with mother. She said, I don't care.
Be back at 9.
Be back at 9.
Mm.
I ran home, right? Like, literally, I got into my house 5 to 9. Walked in, my mum looked at me, she said, oh, what are you doing back?
No.
I was devastated.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, I ran to my house because I wasn't allowed out. Yeah. So the one time I was allowed out,
you're trying to mess up.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wasn't, I wish I had your childhood because boy, I would have been at that Immature concert.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even for me as well, it was that sort of idea, especially within the home, that you were just responsible. Mm. You can just get on with it. So you didn't really, you know, need to talk or need to be vulnerable or need to have, you know, that support. You just got on with it. And it's interesting because I feel now that I've got a better relationship with my mum in adulthood than I did in childhood. And some of our conversations now, even, you know, we reflect on childhood.
Mm.
It's like the things that I would have said, you know, when I was young, I'm just like, oh, you know, yeah. Like I'm saying it now. I don't live at home. So I can say this over the phone to you. And you know, we have those conversations, but how much more would I have needed, you know, those conversations when I was younger? Even in school, it's that idea of, you know, as young black men, you're just resilient.
Mm.
Like, yeah. You hear it. No, chin up.
Mm.
Chin up. Like, soldier it on.
Yeah.
Like, heart on sleeve. Like, we don't, you know, show these emotions. So, you know, even as And that's one of the things that I've really tried to change when I was ahead of year, is that I allowed students to be vulnerable around me. I allow students to be vulnerable That's around good. Me. Sometimes their vulnerability, I'll be able to, you know, engage them in discussions. Sometimes they just sat there and cried.
Mm.
Boys, girls, they just sat there and cried. Turn around, you done? Oh, thank you, sir. Boom.
No, I love that.
That's nice.
Like, you just give them, you know, that space, and you see them at lunchtime after, they're all looking at me, you know, oh, yeah, don't say anything, you know, before. Just, but, you know, I gave them that space because there was something in me that knew that they needed this.
Mm.
I just saw them as a child, like you're 12, you're 13, 14, 16. And, like, even now, in terms of, like, understanding adultification a bit more, like, there were so many students that I would speak to that were sharing their own experiences of the responsibilities that they're carrying.
Right.
They're like, yo, sir, I'm doing this for my brother, for my sister. Yeah. I've got to go pick this up.
Yeah.
Or my parents are relying on me to do, like, X, Y, and Z. Like, they're carrying stuff on, you know, like, their back, and I was, you know, their outlet, essentially. And these conversations, it's not only important for the adults within the school system, but it's important for the adults at home.
So true.
Like, the mums and dads need to hear this.
Definitely.
And relax.
Not even just relax as well, but I feel like there are still so many of us that don't even know that this was our experience. Do you know what I mean? And there's healing that comes with the knowledge, I think, as well. Like, a couple of my friends know that if they phone me and they're talking about stuff and they're like, oh, I want to cry, but I'm not going to cry. I'm like, listen, babe, you better cry. I love a good cry. I don't cry often, but when I feel like I need to cry, I'm going to cry my heart out and then go to sleep.
Right.
There's nothing like a sleep after a cry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So all my friends, I'm like, listen, babe, you go and take a good 30 minutes to cry and then go to sleep. Call me when you get up. You need it, because growing up, I only cried when I was angry.
Right.
I never cried when I was sad. Ever. My tears were always like anger tears. You know that when you're just like so frustrated, you can't release what you want to release. You can't say what you want to say. So you're just crying.
Yeah.
Because you live in a house where you're not allowed to express yourself. You go to school where if you express yourself, they're going to call your parents.
Right.
So you're just constantly like, everything's pent up. So all my tears were angry tears. Like, there was never an incident where, even when my best friend died when I was 18, I was still at sixth form, and my teacher came to tell me about it, and I couldn't cry because I'd never allowed myself to cry because I was sad. And I got home and they'd called my mum to tell her, and I could hear my mum downstairs on the phone to someone saying, oh yeah, she's home. I can tell she's sad, but she's not crying.
Mm.
No, because I wasn't raised to cry. I've never seen you cry when you're sad. Why am I going to be crying when I'm sad? I didn't know how to process or deal with that emotion. So I'm now like encouraging everyone this. If you feel sad, babe, I beg you, just cry. Just cry it out. It feels so good. So I feel like this conversation,
it's good.
For some people, it may make some people cry. Like, actually, this is what I've been growing up with. This is what I've been dealing with. This is what I need to work through.
For sure.
But there's so much power in the knowledge and just having these conversations.
Yeah. And a big thing around adultification came out about 2 years ago after an incident, which is called the Child Q incident, in which a young girl who was at a school in East London, school were concerned about her having, you know, like substances on her, of like drugs or whatever, cannabis, and they detained her in the school, and they contacted police, and police did what the outcome was, you know, an unlawful search, and she was on her menstrual period as well, so she didn't have no adult, you know, present, you know, with her, no support. And I know I've discussed it with you both, you know, behind the scenes, and I just wanted your sort of general thoughts about, you know, that incident. Like, what's the main things like that sort of like come up for you in regard to that incident?
So this particular situation, I know it affected me quite a lot because I used to work in politics and I used to cover policing as a portfolio, and I used to advise my politicians on key issues that they might need to talk about or be aware of. And at the time we were looking at the over policing of certain communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that people want to hear of today. Like, I was literally listening to the radio the past week, and there's a lot of conversations about it's very racially polarizing.
Yeah.
And I don't say this to polarize against, and it's to be inclusive about our experience as a Black community and the policing of Black community in particular. And so when reading about this, it also juxtaposed with the research I was doing around child detention, and that's also another issue that is not really discussed in as much detail. But this, the reason why this affected me and I felt so angered by it is because there is over-policing from a drugs perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We know globally that whether you like it or not, weed is considered a drug that is considered a drug because people couldn't commercialize off of it.
Mm.
The effects of it, there's so much data, we don't need to go into that. But to strip search someone over, to strip search a child,
yeah.
strip search a child over a drug that really, if we break down how you feel about the drug and how much it's being recognized now and people are changing their opinions about it, I think that also needs to be considered. And that's and that's also another reason as to why she was strip searched, because of how people view that drug, but how they view that drug in the context of Black people. So I think this situation is so deep because of where it starts from and people's perceptions of cannabis. And then to take it one step further. Now, look, if she did have the drugs, I'm not condoning that in a school, but what were the ways that we could have gone around that and produce a different outcome? Because there were 4 police officers, by the way.
Mm.
There were 2 men and there were 2 women. And because they were women, it was almost like it was okay, therefore, because you're a woman, you should be able to strip search someone.
Mm.
But actually, there's direct rules around doing this for children. And they wasn't following process. And so when it got to review, so the Independent Police Conduct Authority kind of looked at it, they realised it was gross misconduct. They did completely do the wrong thing. And now why?
You made a good point, because you said there are rules with this that you need to follow when you're conducting it with children. They weren't seeing her as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to this, you know, idea of, you know, adultification. They were seeing her as an adult.
100%. I think traditionally when things happen at school, so even if a child has got something on them that they shouldn't have, unless it's a weapon, for example, parents are called in, or someone, a responsible adult, is called in, right? So when I heard about the case, I was obviously really hurt as well, because I have a little girl, and the idea of her being strip searched by 2 complete strangers, knowing that 2 male strangers are outside, and the fact that she's being strip searched in the place where she should feel safe, right? Because I'm a stalker mom. I track my daughter from when she leaves me to go and get on her train to when she enters her school.
Yeah.
Because I know once she's at school, she's safe.
Yeah.
So for me to hear that a child, a Black girl, is strip searched in the place where I thought we send our kids to be safe, that's what blew my mind. But also, just because those are 2 female police officers doesn't take away from the fact that they are 2 complete strangers who I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not know what you're capable of doing to my child in that space, and then say she's making it up.
Mm.
But who was the responsible adult there to protect her and to let me know if what she's saying is true or not true?
Yeah.
So for me, I was devastated when I heard about it. And I felt, I did immediately go to firstly, I've never heard of that happening to a white child.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, would that happen? Would that have happened if that same girl was white?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. And that's what makes me sad, is that those people were able to, and even the teachers, you know, that school needs to hold themselves responsible for that, yeah, as well, is that you were trusted with somebody's child,
yeah,
and you abused that trust.
But also, what made that get to that level of escalation? Like, why would you call the police on that issue? Do you get what I mean?
Exactly.
And not the parents. Like, I've never, and we've had, you know, when I was working as a head of year, we've never had to call police if a student had, if a student's got weed on them, if a student brings a vape, or if,
yeah,
you wouldn't have to. Like, you'll contact the parents, and there's two issues here. There's two systemic failures. One is the school.
Mm-hmm.
That would have, my school, that would never have happened. That would never have happened. No way. That just wouldn't have happened. Like, the school failed her in allowing that, mm-hmm, to happen in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
In the presence of, like, without having, like, the parent there. Like, honestly, even just thinking about it, just, sense, like, it perplexes me. And two, the systemic failures of the police force. If the first system's failed,
mm-hmm,
and the police force comes after, like, as a police officer, you should be saying, actually, no, this ain't right.
Yeah,
you can challenge.
Mm-hmm.
1,000%.
You can challenge. You can say, actually, this ain't right. And you're telling me there is no, even if something like that were to happen at my school, I would challenge.
Yeah. 100%.
I would say that's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember at the school, the police came and they wanted to come and see a student. And he said, oh, you know, the student's on the playground. We need to go get him. Yeah, you ain't there, PC Tom.
Yeah.
We're going to bring him into the meeting room. Exactly. You're not walking out into the playground.
Exactly.
Like, what do you think this is?
Mm.
It's crazy.
Like, the school is a protective, mm-hmm, factor. It's a protected place, you know, for the student. And I can't imagine to sort of understand, you know, the trauma,
yeah,
that she would have had to go through, you know, that trust in the school system,
though,
that trust in the police force. It's just, you know, it's
and then, yeah, she had to speak. You would expect her to have to speak up at a level of an adult,
mm,
to know her rights as an adult. But why should she? Why would you? You know, like, who really has to go through that to know, I can say that this is wrong and I say no to this.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I think there's a direct abuse of power in that instance, for sure.
I just feel about just the two layers of trauma as well. Because I know, you know, obviously I don't know the child. I don't know kind of their specific background other than, mm, she was a black girl. But I know that growing up in my house, any talk of police,
you're in trouble.
Like, that was, you know, we were taught to fear the police growing up. So, yeah, her seeing the police come in, first of all, is one layer of trauma. Mm. To then be escorted to the toilets while she's on her period feeling vulnerable.
Mm.
And then being told by those same people that she's afraid of to get naked.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Mm.
Crazy.
And just to finish off, what changes do you think, you know, schools,
mm,
establishments, you know, even adults within, you know, the homes, what changes do you think we can make as adults to ensure that, you know, our own children or our young black, you know, girls and boys,
mm-hmm,
are not victim to this adultification bias?
Mm.
I think, like, first of all, let our kids be kids.
Mm.
Like, I'm really big. My daughter wants to be grown so bad.
Yeah.
I'm like, babe, enjoy your childhood. Like, I do not, you know, my daughter's dad thinks I spoil her, but it's because I experienced adultification firsthand. He's, yeah, he was the last born son. He doesn't know what it was like.
Yeah.
So with my daughter doesn't have to cook in my house.
Yeah.
My daughter doesn't have to do the washing in my house. all I ask her to do is tidy up her room and put her washing away and clean up after herself.
Yeah.
Whereas in her dad's house, he's got her doing loads of washing.
Mm.
She learned how to cook at his house. She has, you know, chores. And don't get me wrong, I get that I probably am too far the extreme.
Yeah.
But I'm very conscious of what it created in me. And I want my child to just be a child.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that's one thing I'd say for like black parents raising particularly black girls is let them be girls, just children for as long as possible. Because I think as well, them getting to experience that at home, it will then stand out when they don't get treated like a child outside. It's like, I'm a child. Like, mm. why, you know, what are you talking about? And I think for allies, you know, or people that don't have black daughters or black children, but you're responsible for them in some way, whether that be a teacher, whether that be a counselor, whether that be a youth club leader, is be aware of the fact that society does not traditionally see black girls as black girls.
Mm. Yeah.
And do your part to see black girls and let them be black girls. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd say.
I love that. I would agree. And as someone in the space where I work with young people, it's like, first of all, educating myself on this and also doing better for self. Just because I am, it doesn't mean that I can't know to do better straight away.
Mm.
So I think that's the first thing. And then also having the conversation, I think this space to just really explore it and to meditate on it and to reflect on it has been really enlightening on a personal level. But also now I can have conversations with my godchildren, and actually something that's happened that people can do. A family member asked me to be a trusted adult of one of their daughters. And that just means like creating a safe space for them to come and talk to me should they want to, about whatever they want to. And not putting pressure on what that should look like or how they should be, or projecting my own ideals. And then just finally, like from a school perspective, just recognizing that the conversations that we have in school should be for school.
Mm.
Yeah. We place way too much pressure on girls, boys, black women, black boys specifically to be the best because society's going to look at them in a particular type of way if they don't do 100% and make 100% of the right decisions. And actually, can we encourage them to just explore? And when you talk about having fun or just being a girl, for me, that looks like just being open to have conversations about different routes. Like, you don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to have studied this, this, this and that. Mm. And so what does that look like if it feels a little bit exploratory? Are we allowing them to do that in a safe space that feels freeing and feels creative to their sensibilities rather than the ones that we want to project onto them because we believe that in order for us to project these ideals onto them, then they will be the best upstanding adults. And so, that I guess that's my encouragement all around, just us to encourage people just to explore, to be childlike, to be creative in our nature.
No, I love that.
I think for me, I would say, from the point of view of working with schools, that schools just need to, they need to be willing to get uncomfortable and deal with, you know, these types of issues, whether it's, you know, racism, you know, adultification, that these issues that will make them, you know, feel uncomfortable, because no one wants to admit that they are biased.
Mm.
No one wants to admit that, you know, that they've adultified a child. But I think, you know, being uncomfortable, seeking training, you know, be willing to, you know, reflect so you can be a better practitioner, and in doing so you're offering, you know, the best level of care and education you know, for all the young people and children that you are responsible for. So guys, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. This has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you like this type of content, please subscribe to our YouTube and social media pages, and we will see you soon for our next episode.